turn that into your budget planning and things about service contracts that you definitely need to know. So let's get started. I'll start with the very brief topic of the fact that Office message encryption has some pretty spanking new fancy functionality now, which I think really meets a significant market need that's been out there. The whole topic of being able to send encrypted emails has been it's been a difficult topic for many, many, many years. I mean, we could roll back 20 years and there was really a shortage of ability to send and decrypt by the recipient encrypted emails in a user-friendly manner. That's really the issue. There's always been the capabilities for highly technical people to be able to send encrypted emails. I mean, that's really never been an issue. But due to the technical complexity of being able to send and then decrypt by the recipient these encrypted emails, it's really been a huge roadblock to the adoption of the technology. And what you see in the marketplace are some solutions that I don't even really necessarily think I would call them solutions. There's some that I just completely disregard. I'll give you an example. There's a massively highly utilized encrypted email system that's used by a lot of healthcare organizations. And what it effectively consists of is your doctor, let's say they need to engage in emails with you. They will send you an email through the system. And in order for you to retrieve the system, you have to go there to that website and retrieve it. Now, in this process, first off, there is no multi-factor authentication. And the second component is that all of these emails that were either sent to you or received by you, or you sent and replies, you know, basically that entire chain of communication is all stored on that encryption server. You know, the server that hosts the mechanism by which people go back and forth in their emails to each other in this encrypted manner. So it's effectively, you know, the chain of the encrypted email. Now, that is a massive problem because you don't have that email. Where is it? It's off on this segmented, separatized system. It's not in your regular email. So now it's not part of your normal standard store. It's not part of your archive. It's certainly not part of your legal records. Because why? Because it's not in your email system. And this same statement applies on the healthcare side too for the doctors, you know, and the healthcare providers. Those emails are not part of their email system. And you remember I made the statement about multi-factor authentication. The premise of HIPAA and the High Tech Security Act is, you know, obviously it has many, many things that are stated in there, but one of these elements has to do with, you know, you can't share passwords and you have to put systems in place that enhance the integrity or maintain the integrity of identity. Identity meaning that if Dr. A logs in, then there's a system in place that ensures that that could have only ever been Dr. A, not somebody else pretending to be Dr. A. Now, multi-factor authentication has been around for at least 20 years and, you know, a multitude of flavors, and every single one of us is touched by it on pretty much every system that we use nowadays in some, you know, shape, size, or flavor. So to then say that the most prevalently utilized healthcare encrypted email system does not have multi-factor authentication, that's clearly a step in the wrong direction. And I know quite a lot about this because this particular company wanted me to advocate for their product and, you know, sell it, resell it, set it up, configure it, all of these things. Well, you know, I did my own assessment of it and I found that it was woefully inadequate. You know, So that's just a prime example of how if you don't know any better, then you're going to be taken in by some company's marketing hoopla. And clearly the fact that they are the most prevalently utilized encrypted email system in the healthcare industry indicates that a whole ton of uneducated, uninformed individuals have been making procurement decisions, and that has a direct adverse impact on your healthcare security. And don't be surprised by that, because it's my assessment that 98% of healthcare organizations are woefully inadequate in terms of their security controls. And I'm even talking about hospitals. Yeah, I mean, I have direct knowledge of hospitals not having appropriate controls in place. So, effectively nobody's compliant. It's a really sad state of affairs. Nonetheless, the system that does work extremely well for sending and receiving encrypted emails is Office Message Encryption in Office 365. Now, you obviously have to have an Office 365 plan that includes that capability if you want to be a sender. There are ways that, and of course, you can send to anyone. Now, the new functionality in Office Message Encryption is that now people that already have a Gmail account or people that already have a Yahoo account do not have to create a Microsoft account. They can receive and decrypt those messages no problem. Now, the really sweet part about Office Message Encryption is that there are mail transport rules that can be created that will do automatic encryption on the outbound side based upon criteria and automatic decryption on the inbound side. So let's say your doctor had Office 365 and they emailed you and it was an encrypted email and you reply to them, they are not even going to see that that email response from you to them was encrypted. It will automatically be decrypted for them on the email system and presented to them in their inbox. So this is a massive leap forward in terms of increasing the usability of the product, increasing the security of the product, and this 100% addresses the issue of the email not being included in the main master email store for that person, such as your doctor. So the fact that people are utilizing systems other than Office Message Encryption really has boggled my mind for quite a while, because those other systems don't have multi-factor authentication, whereas Office 365, bar none, has the most sophisticated and user-friendly multi-factor authentication system out there in any sort of a technology realm today. And it's included, right? You're not paying anything extra for it. And if you're the recipient of an Office Message Encryption encrypted email, you can fully make utilization of that multi-factor authentication as well. And this is true whether you have Office 365, whether you're using a one-time passcode, you're using a Microsoft account, a Google account, or now a Yahoo account as well. So I'm going to post an article to this. It has some pretty nice graphics and little screenshots and a really excellent overview of what this is all about. So if you do have Office 365, I would strongly suggest that you download this article and read it to learn more about it and get with whoever is your Office 365 admin and have them make sure that you can send and receive OME encrypted emails properly. So this is, as far as I'm concerned, this is the last detractor's argument for why not to use Office Message Encryption. So what that basically means is there's literally no reason to not use it anymore. All the hurdles to usability and accessibility and friendliness and effectiveness of encrypted email have been removed. It's now so ridiculously easy to send secure encrypted emails. There's just no reason to not do it anymore. All right, so I'm going to get on to the next topic of this whole life cycle question about IT hardware. And this comes up every now and then. And we recently got a question from a reader to the website about expected, how do you, as a buyer, accurately estimate the time of a piece of IT hardware until obsolescence? Now, I don't necessarily use the term obsolescence because I don't know that it's really that that's not why you would replace a piece of hardware. The reality is, if you have a piece of hardware and it's functioning for your business, and here's really the key, and you have an effective support structure in place to maintain and manage that, as well as having an appropriate response time hardware warranty in place, then as far as I'm concerned, you can use that piece of hardware indefinitely. But the reality is that every piece of hardware, based upon the manufacturer and how you purchased it, what level of capacity it has, and what sort of warranty you purchased with it, and of course, you have to maintain these things, those pieces of equipment will have a different expected life cycle, really based upon what the manufacturer is designating. And it varies. It varies. You can't make a generalization for any particular thing like a PC, laptop, server, network equipment, that sort of thing. It varies. It varies between those categories. It also varies between manufacturers. So one of the big things that we do for clients is we function as their virtual CIO. And as part of that, we assist them with writing their 7-year, 5-year, 3-year, and 1-year IT budgets. And the reason that we look at that cycle is because you have different warranty life cycle durations for each piece of equipment that's out there. And the last thing that you want to get into is a situation where you're replacing all the equipment at the same time. So, because that's just too much human labor to expect to be done in one particular fiscal year. A good example of this is let's say you had 20 PCs. And if you purchased all 20 PCs at the same time, that would be a problem because now you have to think about replacing all 20 PCs 5 years from now because you bought them with a 5-year warranty. So I just answered your question of how long should a PC last? Well, it comes down to, did you buy it with an appropriate warranty? So did you buy it with a 5-year warranty? Did you buy it with adequate horsepower to the point where you should be reasonably expecting that it's going to last for 5 years? And as far as I'm concerned, if it's still functioning after 5 years, that's just bonus time, but this is exactly why you don't lease equipment. Leasing is a whole nother topic I'll get on in a bit. But if you need 20 PCs, your optimal strategy with a 5-year warranty is to buy 4 PCs every year, because you really want to be replacing 20% every year. So that way you're not ending up with having, oh my gosh, I have to replace all 20 PCs in 1 year. And I've seen that happen to some people. And you have to understand this is not about whether or not you can come up with the money to pay for 20 PCs in a year. This is more about, do your IT people have enough hours in the day to be able to effectively replace that many systems and work with migrating the end users that use those systems? So this is more of an issue of logistics than and just human raw project capacity than it is about whether or not you can come up with the money to buy those PCs. So the 5-year life cycle for a laptop or a desktop computer is fully expected, as far as I'm concerned, if you're buying a Dell business class computer equipment. If you're buying garbage like Toshiba or Lenovo or HP stuff, and it doesn't have that warranty, I mean, I would not expect that type of equipment to have that life cycle. And this runs into another very big concept that you need to understand, which is this whole idea of what's really the most expensive component of anything that's happening in IT. Well, it's actually the labor. The labor's the most expensive component, not the hardware. You may balk at the cost of a PC with a 5-year warranty on it, or a laptop with a 5-year warranty on it, and go like, "Oh, why is it so expensive? I can go over to Best Buy and I can get one for like $500." Well, maybe you can, and I guess if your time has no value to you and you're a genius and you can do all that labor yourself, maybe that's okay. But the reality is that doesn't apply to 99% of businesses out there. In 99% of businesses, they have to pay for IT labor and IT labor costs, whether it is their internal IT staff or they're using external resources. So it could have hard costs and soft costs. So why would you engage in migration labor every year, every 3 years, when you could have done it once every 5 years? I mean, why would you do that? It's kind of a pointless activity. I've actually seen some very large companies in the past end up incurring massive amounts of additional fees and consumption of IT labor simply because they decided to do something very foolish, and I say very foolish because that is my opinion of it, is leasing servers. So they would lease servers and lease them on a 3-year life cycle. And 100% of the time, now I'm talking about a company that had 500 servers, I'm not exaggerating. Every single time a server came up towards the end of the lease, 6 months prior to that time frame, the IT department or the server team was sitting there thinking, okay, well now we have to go migrate this to another piece of hardware. So first off, you're paying for the leases on two servers for that 6-month duration at least. And 100% of the time, the IT people were saying, boy, this thing's working just fine. Why are we going through this process of doing this migration project and incurring all this change in the organization when there was no actual real legitimate reason to migrate or change anything? It was this fake, false, manufactured deadline, this manufactured reason for migration, simply because somebody in the finance department decided that it was a good idea to lease hardware, and they made that decision completely, apparently, ignorant to the costs of the IT labor to and the adverse business impact of doing all these changes. So I've never seen a circumstance where leasing financially actually cost any company less. There is a large company that I've done some work with that has about 20,000 users, and they lease all their PCs. And they lease all their servers, obviously. And literally, they have at least 5 people per facility whose full-time job, day in and day out, is just simply to cycle desktops and laptops. And they're cycling them constantly because they're leasing these desktops and laptops with a 2-year cycle. And what I witnessed in their cycle was where they would have to buy, they'd have to get all this new equipment in on lease approximately 9 months prior to the date when the old equipment needs to be returned, because it took the IT department 9 months to receive the new equipment and then schedule, you know, build it up and schedule the new migration to, and literally get with each one of the end users to go and migrate all of their stuff and give them this, you know, new piece of hardware, and then go and scrub the old hardware and then package it up on pallets and ship it back. So you're paying for 9 months in that circumstance of two pieces of equipment. You're never actually fully getting the 2-year life cycle value out of that leased equipment due to this, you know, enormous overlap that's occurring all the time. And you're incurring all of this IT labor unnecessarily. There was no other reason to replace this stuff. And when I sat down and I talked to the director of North American operations for IT about this and said, you know, clearly nobody could argue that this is costing you less money. So why does the business choose to do it this way? And he was very blunt about it and said, you know, look, it's really about stock price manipulation, because when you're a publicly traded company, the biggest driving factor that comes from senior executive management throughout the rest of the management chain as a priority is stock price smoothing. And stock price smoothing is such an important thing that they want to drive all expenditure as much as possible to an operating expense model as opposed to a capital expense. And so by leasing equipment, they are engaging in stock price smoothing, where it looks like it's very stable and it has less fluctuations because their income and expenditures are much smoother year over year. And they're not as cyclic, where there's differences every 3 years, every 5 years, every 7 years, these sorts of things. Those cycles don't really exist. Now, I could still make an argument that for an organization of that size, where they had literally just a lot of equipment, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I mean, if you think, if you have, you know, 20,000 employees, how many laptops and desktop computers do you have, right? Just do the math on it. In an organization of say 10 to 13,000 employees is oftentimes going to have 500 servers. So I don't think that it's honest to say that you couldn't purchase these pieces of equipment, the servers and the desktops and laptops and that, on a rolling basis to the point where it would effectively be the same thing as smoothing the income and expenditures. The difference comes down to, are these expenses capitalized and depreciated? Certainly they would be. But again, when you've got that kind of volume, if it's being effectively managed over the appropriate expected life cycle of that equipment, then it's all smoothed anyways. So that's really a project management problem, not a finance problem at that point. All right. Well, you know that I've got 25 years of experience in the industry, and I've never seen where leasing ends up costing less money. And I've never had anybody legitimately make an argument to me that leasing ends up costing less money. So I've never offered that to any client. In some cases, the only reason I see people leasing nowadays is simply because they don't have the money for CapEx, and they somehow think that leasing is going to cost them less money than simply just going to the bank and getting a small loan to cover whatever the capital expenditure is that they need to do. On the other hand, I do see business owners where they'll just be smart about it and go get a loan. So that way they're actually able to engage in the CapEx if they didn't have the cash, but yet they're able to experience the positive benefits of actually having owned equipment. So the labor is the most expensive component, but you need to buy the right equipment with the right warranty from the beginning, and then it needs to be maintained. Now, I want to wrap the show up with the next interesting concept here, which is I was broached a question of whether or not it made sense to just keep some spare hardware in stock, as opposed to maintaining the support and warranty contracts on existing equipment. Now, I'm just going to be blunt. That's just crazy. If you want to have spare equipment, that's fine. Go ahead and have spare equipment, but that is not a substitute for viable, paid-up support contracts on the equipment that you have. So, one of the things you need to understand is that most consultants will not touch equipment that's not under hardware warranty. So, if it's not under hardware warranty, then you can't get manufacturer support for whatever the problem is, whether it's hardware or a software related thing or whatever. So, obviously, I'm talking about something that's more than a hardware warranty, but something more like a service contract for both hardware and software to a certain degree, you know, bug fixes and these sorts of things with the manufacturer. So, that provides you access to firmware updates and it provides you access to escalation support. Now, there are very few consultants that are running their businesses so irresponsibly as to the point where they will accept the liability of making changes to business critical production equipment in your environment when they have no escalation method. And when I say no escalation method, I'm talking about the fact that if you've got a piece of equipment that has no hardware or service contract warranty active on that hardware, then why would they, you know, why would they take the risk of working on that? Because it's probably not up to date, meaning, and they couldn't even get new firmware for it. So if it's got a bug, they can't even fix it because of the fact that it doesn't have an active support contract on it. So, I mean, this whole thing came up because I had this question from somebody who had purchased quite a lot of new switching equipment over the last year. And it was going to cost them $3,000 a year to maintain the support contracts on that switching equipment, which really, by the way, is an absolute microscopic fraction of the cost of those switches. And you know, my statement to them was, look, first of all, nobody's going to touch the equipment if it's not under active support contract. And you can't have an expectation that a viable risk mitigation strategy is to keep a spare switch around, because the reality is there are way more risks that you're trying to mitigate than simply a hardware failure. And even if there was that hardware failure, you would not be successful in replacing the failed piece of hardware with the spare hardware that you had on hand, unless it was an absolutely identical model. And by the way, that it had been kept up to date, your spare equipment had to have been kept up to date, and it has to be under support contract. On the other hand, if you have a failed piece of equipment and it's under an appropriate support contract, then what can happen is the manufacturer is going to send you an identical replacement piece of equipment, and then you're going to be able to restore a configuration back onto that. And it will be successful because of the fact that it was an identical piece of hardware. So I hope that's been useful in terms of helping you understand what makes sense to do, what does not make sense to do, and some understanding about leasing versus buying and expected life cycle of equipment. And as always, if you have questions or comments, feel free to email me.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, now at the Rohde Center for the Arts, featuring Marsh Province Linens, offering a selection of tablecloths, napkins, runners, and more, all crafted in France. Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, Saturdays from 10 until 2.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, announcing a holiday grief share. Learn how to survive the grief and enjoy the holidays again. The free two-hour seminar will be held on Wednesday, November 15th at 6 p.m. in Kenosha. Call 658-4101 to register. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea and Jack's Cafe, featuring Lisa's Famous Chili. This must-have